Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. We've got a great episode for you today. We're going to wrap up all but one of the second round playoff series. We will preview Game 7 of Boston-Washington and the Western Conference Finals. And then we're going to wrap things up with a little bit of NBA draft talk, as the Combine is wrapped up this weekend and the draft lottery is Tuesday. Before we get underway, just wanted to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all three of our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so check us out there. We'd love it if you subscribe, download, left some reviews. Any feedback would be great. And you can find us this year on FanRag Sports, so follow them on Twitter at FanRag Sports and for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. As the offseason gets underway for a bunch of teams, we'll have some good offseason coverage, lots of conference finals previews, NBA draft stuff, so lots of good NBA content at FanRag Sports. As always this week, I am joined by my two co-hosts, Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, you two?
It's going well, Brian. You got that intro down, man.
Yeah, this week I'm also not jet-lagged, so that's helping a lot. Yeah. So, Sarah, your Spurs, let's start with them, because last time we talked, they had just gone up 2-1. You guys went through a little bit of a scare in Game 5 as Kawhi Leonard went down late with an ankle injury. Despite that, Danny Green, Patty Mills, and, of course, Manu Ginobili came up with some insane game-saving, game-clinching plays in overtime. Then Game 6, Leonard sat out. You had no Tony Parker. And yet, if you look at the box score, I mean, it looked like Kawhi must have played for the Rockets because you won by 39 points. So what were your big takeaways for the Spurs from this series?
That's a good question. I think one of the big things is, you know, the young guys came in and kind of held their own. I told you that I've been looking forward to DeJounte Murray in the future, not knowing if he'd get hardly any minutes this postseason, and he may not have had Tony not going down, but it was great to see him bounce back from that sort of rough first outing. And there again, I think Pop has said about him that it doesn't really seem like any moment's ever too big for him, and I think even then that was the case. It wasn't the moment was too big, it was, I think he took a little bit to adjust to the playoff intensity, and of course he had Patrick Beverley across from him. And he sometimes has a tendency, those are the two things he has to work on, is he tends to turn the ball over a little bit sometimes, and he has to work on getting a consistent jump shot. But, man, he really bounced back and had a nice series overall. Jonathan Simmons was really good all series. Mm-hmm. And really, like you mentioned in Game 5, I know Manu's block kind of stands out, but Danny Green.
Yeah.
I wanted to hug Danny Green. Yeah. He was incredible. I mean, he gets so much crap. And he really was the hero, in my opinion, of that. I mean, they all pulled together, but I mean, no one could score on either team for most of the fourth quarter and overtime. and Danny came through. It was incredible.
Yeah, he had a couple big plays there. And I think you're right that Manu's block kind of overshadows everything, but they're not in position to win that game without Danny Green. So we will talk about your Spurs in a little bit because the conference finals are about to get underway. We got to turn to the Rockets now since their season is unfortunately over. Mort, I think the big question, obviously, is what the hell happened to James Harden? In Game 5, you know, he was playing lights out for most of the game, and then come the fourth quarter in overtime, as Sarah mentioned, he just forgot how to score. And then Game 6, he picked about the worst possible time to have his worst possible game of the season. So do you think this was just a matter of fatigue? Was it Pop just figured out how to defend him? Was it he was on drugs, as Stephen A. Smith alluded to?
I thought we agreed that we shouldn't swear on this podcast, Brian.
Right. Sorry.
So I'm not going to mention what SAS said. Look, I think it's a combination of him being fatigued and the Spurs figuring him out, as well as, look, let's be honest, that is a game that where you have to like be at your finest mentally as well. Like, mm-hmm. some guys just crumble a little bit. And I'm not saying that's a pattern of his or anything. I'm just saying that, you know, stuff happens. And I don't really hold this game against him as much as Twitter did. Oh, my God.
Yeah, my God.
Yeah, they were harsh. Look, it was probably the worst way to end the sort of season that he has had, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're putting it under the magnifying glass. But let's be honest, Pop defended the hell out of him in terms of, you know, X's and O's. And he figured him out. And the Spurs, it does lead the league in defense in the regular season. I mean, they were number one for a reason. So, and they figured out, you know what, let's get everyone else to beat us but James. Well,
right.
It worked. And I think that, he, you know, it already began early in the series. And I think it just went to his head a little bit. Whenever he got the mm-hmm. ball in Game 6, he was, like, looking around. He was nervous, which is, again, mm-hmm. completely understandable. He was overwhelmed, and I think people are just being too hard on him. Although, yeah. going to the club afterwards might not might not send the best signal, James.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I did not even see Game 6 live. I was indulging in one of the best sushi feasts of my life. So afterward, I just looked at the box score and was like, what in God's yeah. name happened? And then, yeah, going back and watching it afterward. Mort, I think you're right. I think they did kind of get in his head. And we talked about this last week. You know, Game 1, everyone on the Rockets went off. And Game 4, kind of the same thing. And it was like, it seemed like the Spurs game plan was just do not let him as a passer beat us.
Right.
Let him beat us as a scorer. But then it seemed like in Game 6 he was really trying to force the passing early.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't even take a shot until the second quarter, right? So
yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think he just played right into the Spurs' hands. And it, you know, kudos to Pop. We mentioned it last week. It was a chess match that very one-sided. So now let's look ahead to the what lies next for the Rockets. Sarah, I mean, based on what we thought about the Rockets in the preseason and what we saw how their season ended, but, you know, how they fared throughout the year, would you say this year was a success for them? Was it a disappointment, or was it somewhere in the middle there?
It absolutely was a success. Oh. Yeah, there's no question about that. The last game was a disappointment, no question. Like, even if you're going to end up losing the series, you'd like for them to show a little more than what they showed in the final game. But mm-hmm. but I don't think, no, that doesn't have any bearing on whether their season was a success or not. It definitely was. It will be interesting to see where they go from here, because, you know, they definitely found a style that works for them, especially throughout the regular season and early in the playoffs. But are they going to try to adjust at all? Like, going back to the question about James Harden, I think, like you mentioned, that it was a chess match and it went one way. I think, you know, James Harden was trying to kind of figure out a game plan on the fly in Game 6, and he didn't have a lot of help in that area. And so, like you said, it's like he's trying to force the passing. He feels like he has to get other people involved, and he probably does have to, but the Spurs were forcing him to be aggressive. And he probably mm-hmm. needed to do that first instead, because that's what the defense was giving him. And maybe that would have opened up some of his shooters, but hey, it's tough. I mean, D'Antoni has to come up with some kind of adjustment that doesn't involve the words run or transition or we got to be faster. You know, that's right. All he ever says. There's got to be something else to it than that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Mort, what do you think's next for the Rockets? Where do they go from here in terms of off-season moves? Do they need, you know, are they like Toronto or the Clippers that are facing this big blow-it-up dilemma, or do you think they can basically just run back this same group, win another 50-55 games, and be right back in the mix next year?
Absolutely. Absolutely, that last one. I mean, look, Clint Capella this season played around 24 minutes a game, so essentially a half, and he averaged mm-hmm. 12.6 points and 8.1 rebounds. Like, that's high production for a young center. So he's going to grow. Mm-hmm. And he is really an exceptional pick-and-roll big man. Like, he really reads defenses well in terms of where can he go? Like, what's my lane? Where can I stick, you know, my body, and where can I, you know, dive and where can I jump and everything. Like, he reads it so well, and he has this ESP with James Harden, which is rather incredible. If he just gets somewhat of a touch from around 15, 16 feet, that's going to open everything up for him. So there is like that level of internal improvement, and then they're going to have some available money. I mean, it's not like they can afford someone big, but, you know, they can go out and get some role players. And D'Antoni is likely going to get, you know, him and Morey are probably going to get someone who can shoot. I would just a guess. But yeah, the priority has to be a two-way player, like a Trevor Ariza clone, essentially, because they can't have any more, you know, undersized two guards coming off the bench and just shooting. Like, I love Lou, I love Eric Gordon as well. They are doing an amazing job for him in total. But you need that Tony Allen type coming off the bench.
Yeah, for sure.
With a jump shot.
We should mention, like, you know, Nene got hurt in, I think it was game four, and that was a big absence for them in games five and game six. It, you know, it forced them to downsize, which worked out well for much of game five. But, again, the fatigue seemed like it set in late in game five. Again, we don't know exactly what happened in game six with Harden and the rest, but one could assume they might have just burned out because, you know, throughout the year, D'Antoni was very much like, look, you know, you keep asking me about rest. James isn't having that. He's just not going to listen to me. So, you know, he talked already about he's planning on resting Harden more next year. That could make a difference. I think you're totally spot on with Capella. I forget if it was D'Antoni or Morey who said this, but they were basically saying this dude could be, you know, he might not actually make an all-star game, but he could be an all-star caliber center. He could be that second star that we already have on the roster. So I think you're right on, Mort. I don't think they need to blow it up. They've got a lot of their guys signed long-term, so they're in a good shape moving forward. It's just a matter of filling out their roster. But I think, you know, based on the success they had this year, especially as Sarah alluded to, you know, based on that compared to what we thought they would be, I think they probably will. Whichever ring-chasing veterans don't sign with the Warriors or the Cavs or the Spurs, like, the Rockets are going to be right there in that mix. So they'll have some money to play with. That they should be. Don't worry, Rockets fans. You've got some good times coming up. Let's now switch to the one series, the second-round series that's still going on. John Wall just couldn't let us preview both conference finals, could he? He just had to go and ruin it. So, Game 5 of Boston-Washington, the Celtics just wiped the floor with the Wizards. Game 6, Boston returned the favor of the funeral attire pregame that Washington did during the regular season, dressed in all black. John Wall did not take kindly to that, hit a ridiculous three-point shot in the closing seconds to send it to a Game 7. And then stood on the announce table and said, don't wear all black in my city. So, yeah, that motivational tactic backfired a little bit for Boston. Yeah. So, Mort, let's talk Game 7. It's Monday night, 8 o'clock. What do you think the keys are? All 10 matchups in this between Boston and Washington, regular season and playoffs, have gone to the home team. So, based on that, seems like Boston's probably the favorite, but what do you think Washington can do to break that streak?
Oh, I'm throwing the whole, you know, home court advantage thing out the window. Like, the number one thing you have to write on the blackboard if you're Boston is don't talk to John Wall.
Yeah, right.
At this point, I think he is the second best point guard in the league. I don't see... No, but seriously, like, look at it. Who's better?
Who's the first?
Curry.
Okay, so you think he's better than Westbrook?
Actually, yeah.
And Paul.
Mm. And Paul.
Wow.
I think he is reaching that level now.
Yeah, I mean...
Look, no one talks about him. He's been talking about this, and I've said this on this podcast before. Like, he's out there saying, where's my billboard? I get that.
Right.
Like, this year, his scoring average went up to 23. He averages 11 assists. He's still a terrific defender. He's a wonderful rebounder. He gets to the line. He is no longer a liability shooting wise. And when he's hot, like, he has that ability to go 5 for 8 from outside. So you can't really just let him go from the outside. You have to guard him. You have to have defenders rotate out on him and jump out on him. Whatever he's essentially not, you know, you can't guard him. He's unguardable right now. We're looking at Isaiah Thomas. We're looking at Stephen Curry. We're looking at Russell Westbrook. We're seeing those guys who can put up these huge offensive numbers. And we're never mentioning John Wall because he's not the type of guy who goes out there and gets, you know, 55. Even though I do think he had a 50-pointer this year. He did. Mm-hmm. He actually had one. And he's also had a 40-pointer this year in the playoffs. But we don't talk about him. And I think, you know, we know Damian Lillard is all about, oh, you know, when you ignore me, I'm going to get better.
Yeah, right.
John Wall just shuts the hell up and gets better.
Yeah.
Like, he does it. He puts in the work. And he's not like Dame who chips all the way chirping and, you know, I'm going to get better. You know, he just, he goes out and proves it. And right now, I'm like, he's probably the second best point guard in the league. Because
I think he defends. There's an argument to be made. Right. It's not totally crazy. I'll say that much.
Yeah. I get the Russell Westbrook thing, but like, how much defense did Russ play this year?
Right. And then CP3, just the injuries have to, and the age.
Yeah, and well, it's not even that. It's the fact, look, I love CP3. He steps up to his game, but not to the extent that I want him to. Look at where John Wall was in the regular season and compare it to the playoffs now. Like, his scoring volume has increased. He's scoring like 4 more points a game. Like, he's one of those guys who, instead of seeing his number decrease in the playoffs, he just enhances them, which means that's a serious baller right there. That's a guy you can count on. That's a guy who takes everything seriously. So I'm loving what he does, and I have a feeling that Washington is going to pull this one out. He is going to be all in. And Isaiah Thomas, over the last 4 games, 19.3 points a game on 39% shooting. He has to go out and get 40.
Yeah, he had the opportunity in Game 6 to end the series, which, you know, with 2 seconds left, which should have been 3, as the NBA later said. But it was a little off target there. Sarah, where do you stand on Game 7? Who do you see winning? What do you see the keys to that game being?
I am a little worried about the game being in Boston, but I think I'm going to stay with what we said last week, because we all just want to see the Wizards move on.
Right.
So I'm going to say the Wizards find a way to pull it out in Game 7. As they even mentioned, they've been close in Boston. Mm-hmm. They just have not been able to finish games, so that will be a big key. Points in the paint, I think when they win that battle, they have a pretty good chance, so hopefully they can get into the paint a little bit. But yeah, just obviously try to stay with IT. If you keep them shooting sub 40%, that's pretty big. I don't think they'll keep them that low, but like 45 wouldn't be terrible. Try to make him a volume scorer, volume shooter. See what happens. Obviously, Wall and Beal have to go off. That's the other kind of unheralded moment. John Wall's 3 stands out, but Bradley Beal hit a 3 just before that to help steal that game too. So those guys got to be big. I think they will be. I hope so.
Question is, like, do they really need to? Because when you look at Game 6, Otto Porter didn't score in 36 minutes. So if he carries his responsibility, like gets 15, that's 15 points that you don't really need from the 2 other guys. Like, I don't think there's any chance in hell Otto Porter goes scoreless again in 36 minutes. So
I hope not.
No, that's but it's, I'm right there with you. I think Washington right now has this series in the palm of their hands. I would be very impressed with Boston, let me just put it that way, if they take this from them.
See, my heart is saying Washington, but my brain is saying Boston, because as you mentioned, and we talked about last week, I think a Washington-Cleveland Eastern Conference Finals is just more entertaining. That said, having lived in D.C. for 8 years and witnessed what happens to D.C. sports teams, they routinely go into these situations and just find new and more vicious ways to disappoint their fans. So, having just watched the Caps collapse last week in Game 7 at home, I am worried. I think last time I said Washington in 7, I think I would lean toward Boston this week, just because it's D.C., and this is what D.C. teams do. But we'll see what happens Monday, Game 7, I get 8 o'clock. Hopefully, our boys in DC can pull it out. Let's move on to the other two series that closed out. They were a little less surprising in their outcome.
Yeah.
Warriors, Jazz. I mean, George Hill missed the last three games, so it was just that, you know, the Jazz already needed a perfect confluence of circumstances to topple the Warriors, and that did not happen. You know, after the sweep was official, there was this weird Twitter backlash on, like, Monday and Tuesday about the Warriors being too good and ruining the playoffs, and then how all of a sudden, like, this entire playoff sucked, even though the first round was great. It was, like, two relatively unsurprising sweeps somehow made the Warriors even, you know, the NBA's bane of their existence. And then Warriors fans, of course, became more defensive, and that was just a whole... Twitter was not a good place to be this week. So... Sarah, I mean, your Spurs, as we'll talk about shortly, are now going against the Warriors. Do you buy into this storyline that the Warriors have ruined the playoffs by being too good?
They haven't ruined the playoffs. I think their games have been somewhat boring, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets old after a while seeing teams not really be able to get it much closer than, you know, 10. And if you can be within 10 at certain quarters of the game, then that's a success. That's kind of sad. And although, like, you know, Utah did have moments where they were right there, it felt always inevitable and ended up happening that Golden State just pulled back away again. So it gets disheartening to watch as a fan who just wants to see something close.
Yeah.
But no, they haven't ruined the entire playoffs. Just thankfully they don't play every game every round.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope they don't. I mean, yeah. Now they will, but...
Yeah, yeah.
The other big Warriors-related storyline from the last week was Draymond Green on his Dre Day podcast opined about Kelly Olynyk. You know, last week we mentioned that he had a little scrap with Kelly Oubre. Draymond said he had no respect for Kelly Olynyk, called him a dirty player. Sarah, thoughts on that one?
I will say that Olynyk has earned some of that. Like, I mentioned that a few weeks ago, that, mm-hmm. you know, some of the things he's done are definitely questionable. But, yeah, it's a little hypocritical for Draymond to call anybody dirty. He's definitely walked that line and skipped over it a few times himself, so that's just funny. And it's funny that he doesn't think that it's ironic at all.
Right.
It's like, what? Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, right. I know. Then he got mad at the media for bringing this up and making it a storyline, as if, like, what were you expecting to happen, Dre? It's not... It's like when, yeah, Donald Trump gets mad at the media for reporting facts.
I don't know. I think he's trolling us.
It seems like it probably is. Yeah.
I don't think that you, as a human being, can be that... I don't know, you know, just completely clueless as to the situation.
You'd be surprised, though. mean, some people, like, have no self-awareness, or that's it's okay because whatever they do is okay because they do it. You know?
Yeah, you know, you might be right. He's
probably too smart for that.
I might just have too much hope for people. I don't know.
Right. Maybe he's saying, because what Kelly, like, he's pulling the arm bar and doing hard screens, and that's dirty, but kicking dudes in the dick is fine. That's clearly
his
train of thought.
Different set of standards.
Yeah, right. He has standards, yeah. Okay, more. Let's talk about the Jazz then, because they, like a bunch of other teams that just got knocked out, are facing a pretty critical summer. Mm. Gordon Hayward is all but certain to opt out of his contract, likely facing a max either from Utah, Boston, Indiana, we've heard talks about. George Hill is on the wrong side of 30. He's a free agent. Mm. Joe Inglis is a restricted free agent. He's probably looking at least 12 to 15 million a year.
Yeah.
George Hill, at least 20, if not more. So what do you think Utah does this summer? Do you think they roll it back if they can? Do you think they let Inglis walk and re-sign Hill and Hayward? What would you do if you were in charge of the Jazz?
It all depends on Hayward, obviously. Like, if he leaves, then there is no reason to re-sign George Hill or Joe Ingles, because Ingles himself is like 29, I think.
Mm-hmm.
29, 30, something like that. So that wouldn't even make sense. So that let the first pawn fall, and let's see where Gordon ends up. Like, I have a feeling that Gordon sticks with Utah, though. I mean, look, he... I don't remember when this was, if it was in the first round or it's in this round, but at the end of the game, one game, I think it was in the first round, actually, he got interviewed after a game, and the fans were just, like, completely overwhelming him, like, with support. He was looking around the stadium while he was talking to someone, and just, you could just see that it hit him. It really hit him. And I'm not the type of guy who usually says, oh, when you have an emotional moment, that's going to carry over. But yet this time, it seemed like it could. Like, Gordon was legitimately moved. He looked around and was like, yeah, this is my town. This is my town, this right here. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him stick around Utah at all. In fact, I would actually be surprised if he left.
Yeah.
So, you know, and if we use that as a measuring stick, then, yeah, they should get George Hill and Joe Inglis back, even if it's going to cost them a hell of a lot, because what are you going to do otherwise?
Right.
So, it's... Yeah. So, all in if Gordon is in. If not, build around Gobert.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I like you, do not think Gordon Hayward is going anywhere. I don't know. It doesn't, you know, you could kind of tell most of the time when a big free agent is at least entertaining the thought of leaving.
Yeah.
Like, there just seem to be a few calculated leaks. Like, and even, you know, Jimmy Butler and Paul George are not free agents. They would have to be traded. But, like, there's a lot of smoke around those guys. And, you know, it's rarely like a Carmelo Anthony, Phil Jackson situation where a team president is literally forcing the guy to leave. But... yeah, I mean, from all indications, it sounds like Gordon wants to go back. Utah would happily have him back. It sounds like they will max him without question. So I'm expecting him to stay. I get nervous about a max deal for George Hill because, again, he's already past 30. But
would you max him, though? Like, do you think he's getting max? Is probably a better question. I can't imagine him getting a max.
I know, because this year, I'm going to write about this soon, but this year the max is just so prohibitive that I feel like any team that maxes, I mean, hell, you know, even Hayward, like, he's going to get the max, but that could look ugly in a couple of years.
What?
Like, the max is, it's just, yeah, it's so huge. It's just such a huge amount of money that, like, it's gone to the point now. You know, the max under the old cap and under the old structure, it was like you could give the max to, you know, guys outside the top 10, top 15, top 20. Like, you can give it to Harrison Barnes, and that's just fine because that's how the old salary structure was.
Right,
but,
right.
Like, now it's going back to the point where it really should be reserved for, like, top 10, top 15 players. And then, you know, George Hill... Give him $25 million to start, but that's better than 30 or 35.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I think if he's like, I'm going to leave if I don't get a max, like, Sacramento has offered me the max and I will willingly go to Sacramento, then I guess you have to. But I would hope he would be willing to take, like, 4 years, $100 million or something and call it a day. Because that's still an astronomical amount of money, but it's not.
That's a Giannis contract, actually.
Yeah, right.
Well, I still disagree in regards to Gordon Hayward, though. I think he's on the uptick. I know, he had a great year this year, and I think he's going to build on it. I don't think he's done growing at all. It wouldn't surprise me one bit to see him become like a 25.8 rebound, 5 assist guy at some point.
Yeah.
Okay, 8 rebounds is actually a little bit more. I just looked at his numbers. He's never been up in that category, but... He's going to be one of those top-tier forwards in the league, so I don't really have a problem maxing him out. But like you said, like, George Hill is not on that level. He's like a tier below at least, if not two. I probably would, even myself, would go 25 is a bit much when you consider his age. Yeah. So I would be more open-minded to say, you know what, George, I'm going to max you for 2 years... Or I'm going to stretch it out a little bit longer and then get you down to, like, 20 a year. That'd be fine. Like, max him for two because then he's productive in year 31, year 32. That's fine. and then you can renegotiate afterwards. But if he says, I want the long-term, you know, commitment, I want the long-term security, then you say, you know what, 80, 85 million over four years. That's it.
Yeah, if you could. I mean, going back to Hayward, here's my thing. Like, the max salary for him next year would be $30.3 million, which in his age 27 season, fine. In his age 31 season, he would be getting basically $40
million. Right.
So that's where it gets dicey. Like, the first 2 or 3 years of his contract, totally fine. Those last 2 years, though, he's going to be making about $77.5 million.
Well, 31 isn't that much anymore if you look at age. Like, you know, NBA teams are so adept now at keeping these guys fresh, and the longevity is just, you know, going through the roof. I am looking at the age 32 as, like, the cutoff. After you have your age 32 season, that's when I start to get a little bit, you know, nervous. 31, right. that's like end of your prime. That's still good. It's not, you're not, you know, it's starting to decline, really. You're just wrapping up your prime, nice and cozy.
Can Gordon Hayward be the number one option on a championship team?
Oh, but that question, though, is such a difficult question. Like, I saw that being asked about Jimmy as well. And, like, we don't know. Like, I mean, you know, and it really, even if he could be, how can we know when you have super teams?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Because if you're paying him $40 million, you cannot build a super team around him. You can't get two other superstars around him.
But if you look at it from a more traditional perspective, like without super teams, I think he could go really, really far.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's that good. And one thing we haven't talked about, you know, regarding Gordon all year is his defense. It's been outstanding.
He improved a lot this year.
Yeah,
on both ends. Like, he played. You could not ask for much more in a contract year for him. It's just...
Right.
I just keep going back to $40 million, and that's a lot of money if you're not sure he can dominate on both
that's
ends.
That's right, it is. It is. It's a good question, you know, if he could be, like, the lead guy.
Mm-hmm.
No, in this current climate, probably not. But then you can ask Kawhi Leonard. As much as I love Kawhi Leonard, and he's arguably, you know, a top two NBA player right now.
Mm-hmm.
Will he be the best player on a championship team if you have to go up against Golden State with KD, with Curry, with Dre and Klay? You know, I mean, it's such a difficult question. Like, obviously, he's talented enough, but he will always have to go up against this, you know, the big monster.
Right.
So, yeah. I think it's kind of an unfair question to Gordon as well.
Yeah, that's whichever team figures out how to work under this new salary cap first and under this new structure first is going to win multiple rings. But it's a weird time for teams to have to re-sign these players because you don't know how the league is going to look in 3 or 4 years. And that's what makes these decisions so difficult. So this is actually a good segue into, we'll talk about Cleveland once we can preview the Eastern Conference Finals. So, you know, we talked about Toronto last week a little bit. I want to go right back into that because this is, you know, Toronto, Clippers, Hawks, Jazz for a different reason. You know, the Jazz, I think, if they could bring it back, they will. Toronto, Clippers, Hawks, like, there's a real question of whether they should blow it up and whether that's a better outcome. Because if they re-sign everyone, they're going way into the luxury tax. They will not have the cap space to really fill out their benches. Masai Ujiri gave a press conference the other day, like after they got swept, and he said, look, it's not realistic to expect all four of our major free agents back. We have Lowry, we have Tucker, we have Ibaka, and we have Patrick Patterson. In all likelihood, if they're going to get rid of one, it's Patrick Patterson.
Oh, obviously.
But even if they, you know, if they bring back all four, Zach Lowe of ESPN had an article about kind of their future. I'm saying, like, it could cost them $250 million, including luxury tax payments, to bring back these teams. Which, you know, a team that just got swept in the conference semifinals.
Right.
By LeBron and the Cavaliers. So, you know, you were on the blow it up camp last week. Are you still there for Toronto?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you know, that team has just disappointed for so long now in the postseason. Like, I legitimately thought they had broken that pattern this year when they got Ibaka, because then they finally had this big versatile, you know, stretch four slash defender they could play off of.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made zero difference, really. Mm-hmm. Like, DeMar DeRozan still got absolutely abused because he can't shoot the three. Kyle was in and out due to injuries, so that's kind of unfair to him. But still, he didn't really, you know, explode in the manner that he could. And everything just seemed off. Demarre Carroll was awful. It's just such a large amount of money that you can't roll that team back. And by the way, while we're at the subject, $250 million. I'll just reiterate what I said a couple of months back. Just $1 million to our podcast, guys. Just $1 million. One bloody million. Come on. Just chump change. In this market, why not? Come on, guys. Just one bloody million. I'll take it. They should definitely not roll it back. But, you know, they might even have their hand forced if Lowry goes to Philly, which we've heard about.
Hey, no.
Hey, look, I'm not trying to crab on your team. I'm just talking about the rumors. And you know, he's a North Philly guy, unless I'm mistaken. Villanova guy, you know.
Yep. Yeah, we'll talk about that if it actually comes to fruition. That will not be a good day for us. Let's get past the draft lottery first.
Right, but if that happens...
I know. Right, yeah. At that point, you definitely... It just like Utah in that regard, and same with the Clippers. You know, if one of those guys leaves, that forces your hand. But if they're willing to come back on the max, then you kind of build around them.
Yeah.
You know, I think... there was a Twitter thread from Ben Falk, who was the former 76ers vice president of basketball strategy, and he worked with the Blazers before that as an analytics manager. He had this thing the other day kind of about, in reaction to Lowe's column on the Raptors, and how, you know, obviously in the NBA, the goal is to win a championship. That's the number one priority. In a perfect world, every team would be a championship contender. Obviously, that's not the case. There are only so many wins to go around. Some teams are bound to suck. His thing was like, well, if you're not going to be a Golden State or a Cleveland or a San Antonio, what's next most important to you? Are you going to prioritize everything on chasing a ring, and you're going to sacrifice, you know, you're going to pull a Hinkie basically and, you know, blow up your team, go through a number of years of rebuilding to accumulate draft picks and young players that could develop into a championship contender? Or are you cool with, like, a 50-win team that makes the second round of the playoffs every year and that gets fans in, you know, in the stadium for playoff revenue, and with a lucky break or two, like, maybe LeBron James finally slows down a little bit, or maybe he, like, sprains his ankle or something, and, you know, think about Bulls-Sixers from a couple years ago, Mort. Like, maybe game one, your superstar tears his ACL, and now a number 8 seed can topple the number 1. So it's, you know, in that context, I think it's really interesting to think about Toronto and the Clippers, and I think I wouldn't be surprised to see either team run it back. I feel like Toronto has a better chance of doing so than the Clippers. I just have a sneaking suspicion that Blake Griffin is ready to peace out on the Clippers, maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, because Toronto, yeah, it's if you re-sign Kyle Lowry to the max, it's 5 years, $205 million, which is going to be... You know, in his age, I think 35 or 36 season, you're paying him $46.7 million.
Ugh.
Which, you know, I just said I was nervous about 40 for Gordon Hayward in his age 31. Like, that is terrifying. But at the same time, if you let Kyle Lowry walk, you don't have the cap space to replace him with anywhere near his caliber of point guard. So unless you trade Demarre Carroll or trade Jonas Valanciunas, you're basically forced to run it back, and then if things go south, then you start looking, maybe I trade DeRozan. I mean, I feel like if they could flip Valanciunas or Carroll, they would do it in a heartbeat, if they could do it without giving up any major assets or getting something of value in return.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, yeah, I mean, Sarah, I want to ask you about this, because Jesse Blanchard, the editor-in-chief of B-Ball Breakdown, got into a convo with me the other day about this. It sounded like in 2011, people were clamoring for the Spurs to blow it up. And then they luck into this little-known prospect named Kawhi Leonard, and the rest is history. So where do you stand with Raptors, Clippers, all these teams kind of at this crossroads? Do you think, is it worth it to, you know, they've got a nice 45-50 win core, should they keep that going and pray for a lucky break, or do you think it's time for some of these teams, they've just gotten stale and need to reboot?
That's why, you know, even with the Clippers, who I think if anyone's gotten stale, it's probably them. Mm-hmm. That's why I've been a proponent of them keeping it together for as long as I have. I just think, you know, it's good to be close. It's good to, you know, speaking from having 20 years of a successful team, you know, that, yeah, they haven't won it every year. They haven't won it even close to every year, but you always kind of felt like they had a chance, mm-hmm. and they just were fun to watch, you know? There's something to be said for having a team that you enjoy watching for 82 games, regardless of what happens after that. And even, like, hearing Morton talk about, Joe Ingles? Mm-hmm. He's, 29? He's like, well, you know, like, my inner Spurs fan rebels against that. It's like, oh, my God, you know, we got to move on because he's hitting 30, you know, obviously. Obviously, that's very different from my experience, but, you know, it doesn't always work that way. You don't always have a guy who's like Tim Duncan who can push that longevity and be that effective well into their late 30s. But yeah, for the most part, I'm on the side of keep it together, mm-hmm. Run it back. You're close enough. So you never know what way it's going to break. And yeah, you know, hopefully for those teams, like, the Spurs have been lucky in the draft. They've done well with prospects, even not having high or low, however you want to say it, great draft picks, great value. They find something. I think, you know, you develop your scouting department and hope for the best. But yeah, I've gone back and forth with the Clippers, especially lately, just because it feels. And Doc Rivers has even said that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Teams do get stale, and you gotta move on. I don't think he wants to do that with this particular team, but you can feel it. It's weird. There's a weird sort of juju surrounding that team.
Right.
So yeah, it's anybody's guess on that one. But yeah, as a Spurs fan, yeah, I rebel against some of that talk because I just, yeah, it's been such a different experience for us, but at the same time, it's been somewhat exceptional, so...
Right.
You know, it's hard to argue that that's the rule.
Yeah, I think it's hard for... Mort, you and I, you know, both of our teams have just been mired. I mean, your Bulls, you know, the Rose Noah Bulls were actually really good, but now the Bulls are kind of mired in mediocrity, and before Hinkie came along, the Sixers were the same way. Like, they were in that, like, 35-40 win area, which I think is very different than consistently 50 wins every year. I think those are two different conversations to have. I think if you've got a 50-win team, ownership is a little more reluctant to blow it up just because, you know, you might not be the favorite, but you're right there. You're, like, comfortably going to make the playoffs every year. And Zara, you're right. Like, there's something to be said about, you know, the NBA. Of course, the goal is to win a championship, but it's also an entertainment product. And, like, people want to pay to see an entertaining, fun, good team that has a good chance of winning every night. They don't want to pay to see the 2013-14 Sixers, which is very evident by the Sixers, you know, their attendance the last couple of years. So, well, I think for both, it's just going to come down to what ownership prefers.
Right. I'm so glad you guys brought up, like, the entertainment level. Remember Run TMC back in the early 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that... I'm gonna swear, that shit was fun. Like,
right.
Look, if the NBA is listening in on this, I'm gonna admit to something. I've downloaded so many illegal games from the internet of the Run TMC era. Mitch Richmond, Tim Hardaway, Chris Mullin, Tyrone Hill just running up the court every damn day. They had, like, a thing where everyone in the crowd, they got free pizza if they scored 120. And they just scored 120 consistently. Like, everyone got free pizza all the time, and people were just having so much fun because these scores were amazing, and they had this ridiculous offensive flow. And it was just like an enjoyment. Even if they lost, people were like, oh, okay, you know, that happens. But oh my God, I was entertained. Mm-hmm. And then they made the playoffs. And I even believe it was against your Spurs, Sarah. And they actually had a somewhat decent series. And people were just like, the love and support they got back then, because they had gone through all those years where they had given it all to entertain the crowd. Then when they reached the playoffs, the level of support was just rock solid from the entire fan base, which was incredible. So I'm a big proponent of, if you're not going to win, then at least be entertaining. Like, the Bulls back in the day did something of the sort, even though it was, as you know, a totally suspect basketball move when they traded Elton Brand for Tyson Chandler. Stupid-ass trade, but at least they got fun, because Chandler was this athletic 7'1", at that point in time, power forward who ran the court like a deer. Then you had Eddie Curry at the same time, who was this Shaq copy, at least he was supposed to be, and they were just dunking on fools all the time. It was it was a lot of fun. Like, even if they lost, it was at some level fun. And you had Jamal Crawford, who then, you know, did a lot of street plays and whatnot. They tried to bring out a culture of excitement. Obviously, I was a teen at that point, so I got excited watching that. But it felt as though it was necessary, because if you weren't going to win, at least you would put, you know, a smile on the faces of all the fans that attended. I think if I was to run an NBA team, that would definitely be my approach. That would be my goal. If I knew I had a crap team, make that crap team as fun as possible.
Yeah, right. Right. Which the Sixers tried to by just running up and down the floor for the last couple of years. They just had
caliber
players. Yeah, right.
Like, imagine Ben Simmons next year. Like, that's going to be fun.
Well, hey, hopefully they won't be as crap of a team next year.
Oh, they'll be crap. They just won't be, like you said, as crap, but
right.
I mean,
yeah. Right. Yeah. All right. Let's change gears here. Let's go into the conference finals previews. We are recording this on Sunday afternoon before Game 1 of Warriors Spurs. So full disclosure, we have no idea what's about to happen. But that said, when the lines opened, Warriors were favored by 10 points in Game 1, and they were commanding favorites in the series. Sarah, are you feeling disrespected?
Well, I heard that it's now just 9.5 points, so hey, we're moving on up. No, I don't feel disrespected. It's such a weird place to be, because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what to expect. It's probably the first time ever, which is absurd in itself, but it's probably the first time ever going into a series that I have, like, no expectation for anything. I don't even have, like, a solid, reasonable hope that they're going to win. It seems like, you know, maybe the Warriors win in 5, maybe 6 would be, like, best-case scenario for a competitive series.
Right.
Not that you can't have a competitive sweep. I mean, Cavs-Pacers was pretty competitive.
Yeah.
But, man... It's going to be something. First of all, I came straight here from like a Mother's Day brunch. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
Yes.
And my dad gave me the directive that I'm supposed to tell everyone. My old man says Spurs in 7.
Really? Wow.
I like it.
That's good.
Which I appreciate. I appreciate that confidence.
Yeah.
I can't quite go there, but I appreciate that, Pop. It's gonna be interesting, you guys. I hope it is, anyway.
I know. God forbid the Warriors continue ruining the playoffs. So let's talk keys to the series. Obviously, Kawhi Leonard's health is going to be the big one. We don't know how healthy he's going to be. Pop has said he's going to play Game 1. So let's talk the bigs, Sarah. How are LaMarcus Aldridge, Pau Gasol going to fare against the Warriors in general, but especially against the death lineup with Draymond at the 5?
It's going to be tough. Because a lot of what they did, and let's give them some credit, they put a successful spin on the Houston series. They put their imprint on it. You know, struggled mightily through parts of it, but actually provided some rim protection that changed the series a little bit, Pau and LaMarcus both. But a lot of times you would see Pau, especially, sagging way the heck off of Harden coming off of the pick, especially out near the three-point line. You know, he would be, like, way back in the paint, kind of daring Harden to pull up, and you can't do that with Steph Curry. You know, you can't do that with Kevin Durant, really any of the Warriors. So that's all going to be interesting. You know, the fact that the Rockets just really hate that, you know, non-paint too will not take it, even if you draw a circle around and say, we won't even come anywhere near this. Go ahead and have it. They're like, no, we don't want it. So, you know, the Warriors will take that. They also will push past. I think, you know, Harden is a pretty crafty, good finisher, but he struggled there toward the end of the series. I think Steph is a very, very good finisher that he doesn't always get credit for. So they're going to go at that. The Warriors are going to attack, and I just don't know how Powell and LaMarcus are going to be able to deal with that. On the other end, you know, they have to try to impose their will. They have to try to really own the glass. That's a big thing against anybody, really, but especially the Warriors. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can't give them 2 and 3 chances if they miss the first shot.
Sure.
And you have to really own the offensive glass because, like I said, usually you can't score with them, so you're going to have to get extra opportunities. So they've got to do that. LaMarcus has struggled with Draymond. Everyone struggles with Draymond. He's probably the defensive player of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going to have to find ways to, you know, rim run, try to get set up close to the basket, try to get into paint to begin with. But Draymond is really good at not letting you do that. He does his work early.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, you don't want to bang with him too much because, you know, it's always been deceptive that you think, oh, I can just push him over. You can't push him over,
right.
So don't get stuck trying to do that. He's going to hold you up and the guards are going to come dig and you're screwed.
Yeah.
So just try to turn and shoot over him because you do have the height and the length advantage. God, hopefully we'll see some of that, but I just don't know. We haven't seen a lot of it in their matchups the past 2 years. It's really been Draymond kind of owning it, so... And hopefully we'll see some, like, Kawhi, LaMarcus pick and roll, pick and pop would be nice. Patty and Kawhi pick and pop, something, you know. They've got to get the ball moving. Because, yeah, our best offense is often a Kawhi ISO or sometimes a LaMarcus post-up. But you can't get away with that all game long against that defense. It's too good.
Yeah, definitely not. So how much do you think we're going to see out of the complimentary guys? You know, you mentioned Kawhi and LaMarcus. You know, a lot of those guys, especially once Parker went down and when Leonard sat out the last game in a quarter, you know, we mentioned Simmons, Patty Mills, Murray, Danny Green, they really stepped up. Do you think they're going to be able to against the Warriors?
I do, and they're going to have to.
Yeah.
If the Spurs are going to have any chance. Actually, I've said this about John all year, back to game one, because I saw that in the very first game of the year.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably his best game of his life, his best game of his NBA career thus far. So it's unreasonable to expect that, you know, there's a probability that he could do that every game.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had like 20-plus points. He blocked Steph Curry at the chase-down block. That was incredible. You know, he's probably not going to be able to give you that every single game of the series, but you hope. I mean, what we saw against the Rockets, he averaged double figures. He was very, very solid with the ball. They'll need that. They need his punch off the dribble, his, you know, cutting into the lane. I've said he's going to be an X factor. Not that they can get by without it. They can't. Mm-hmm. He's got to be good for them to win. And hopefully, I'm pretty sure Pop's going to play him some minutes, some solid minutes. I hope so, because I do think he's a big key. I think he's earned Pop's trust because he was really good last series. We'll see what happens with DeJounte, because I just think they're going to have to switch it up a little bit. They're going to have to try some things.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to just roll out what they rolled out for most of the year and have it work.
Definitely, yeah. All right, Mort, I'm going to turn this one to you. The Spurs had the best defense in the league this year. The Warriors had the best offense in the league. Do you think the Spurs have any chance of slowing down this Warriors death assault?
Slowing down, yes. Winning, no. I mean, yeah, I think they need to give, you know, Dwayne Dedmon more minutes this series.
Mm-hmm.
He's really going to be a necessity. And also offensively speaking, because he can roll to the basket, he can, you know, grab lobs, and they need to get some points in the paint. They really do. And hopefully they get their free ball going, but they're not going to be able to stop that offense. Like, they have to respond offensively, mostly. Having said that, if they can shave some points off of the total for the dub series-wise, that's going to be huge. I'm not sure how they're going to do it, especially if... Because here's the thing. The Warriors are just so good at identifying weaknesses. They're going to zero in on Powell immediately. They're going to look at all the things that he does wrong, and they're going to exploit them until you know Pop just benches him. That's going to be a thing. So I wonder if the best bet for San Antonio is to go small and then run Dedmon at the 5, Kawhi at the 4, Jonathan Simmons at the 3, and then fill it out with Danny and, I don't know, maybe Deontay? Not sure. Like, because he's athletic and he's cat quick, so you might be able to live off of that. But no, you're not gonna stop that epic offense. Like, how are you going to stop KD when he's isolating? How are you going to stop, you know, Clay when he's just moving around the goddamn court? Like, he's going to get those shots either way, right?
Yeah.
You're basically hoping for them to have an off shooting series.
Yeah, right. That sounds about right. So it sounds like we're all taking the Warriors. Sarah, how many games do you see this one going?
I've gone back and forth. My official prediction was going to be Warriors in 5. But you know what? It's worth it. I'm just going to live on the wild side. Why not? I'm going to go out with my boots on. Spurs in 6.
Whoa. Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Finally. Why not? I've been waiting for that. Come on.
That's nice. You had no confidence in the Spurs against the Rockets, but now against the Warriors.
you know what?
Going all in.
Brian, you know what? Sarah just tricked us all throughout the podcast. She was just waiting.
Right?
This was a setup. Like, all year long, it's like, oh, I don't know. I'm kind of afraid to put them in this situation. It feels wrong. I'm going to jinx them. And then in this one series that they're probably going to end up losing, she just goes, Spurs in 6, y'all. Come on.
But see, you can jinx the favorite. I don't know that you can jinx the underdog.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Probably not.
So why not?
That's fair. Yeah. I kind of like that.
That's true. Mort, are you slow playing me too, or you have the Warriors in this one?
I have the Dubs in 6, and I went on the record already and said it on Beeple Breakdown, but right now when I'm hearing Sarah's enthusiasm, I want to get caught up in it, but then I remember that you talked me into the Raptors going to the finals, so I'm not gonna go up with all the hype here, but let me just put it this way. I think it's going to be the Warriors in 6. I'm hoping it's going to be the Spurs in 7.
Oh my God. Well, I am going to rain on both of your parades because I have the Warriors in 5. I don't know. I hope you guys are right because I do want this to be more.
I really don't expect them to win.
No.
Yeah, I really don't.
Right. It could be a sweep. Like, it really could.
Right. It really could. I'm going to go gentleman sweep Warriors in 5. Okay. So we can't preview the Eastern Conference Finals again. Thank you, John Wall. Let's just ask this, Mort. Regardless of who wins Game 7, does either team have a chance against Cleveland?
Yes.
Ooh. Which one? Ooh. Or both?
Washington.
Nice.
I'm digging what Washington is doing right now because it seems like they are just clicking. And Bradley Beal and John Wall, whatever, I don't know if that beef was legitimate.
Yeah, right.
I have no idea. I don't care. I just know that right now, those two seem like boys. Like, they really do. They seem like those two are in tune, and they're friendly, and it seems that chemistry is really showing on the basketball court, which is mostly essential. Otto Porter is this era's version of Sean Marion, as far as I'm concerned. You have Markieff Morris, who can stretch the floor. You have Marcin Gortat, who can really, you know, punish you inside. I think it's the best bet. I'm not sure that they could win against Cleveland because, you know, the LeBrons are amazing. But I think they could put a scare into them. And this is just a theory of mine. Bear with me. I do think that LeBron James is, stay with me now because it's going to sound ridiculous, I think he's human. I think he's actually of the human race, which means there is like a small risk of him actually being human in a playoff series. And if that happens, that's, you know, however unlikely, and trust me, it is definitely unlikely.
Right.
I think Washington is the one team that could exploit that fact the most.
Yeah, because of their guard play, because that's a weakness for Cleveland.
Especially that, and also weakness, right, and also because when you look at Boston, they have one guy, like offensively speaking. I love Al Horford; he's doing well. Like Avery Bradley is a surprising scorer, but they have that one guy who can routinely create something for him, and that's just not enough. As much as I love Isaiah Thomas; he is one of the most, you know, intoxicating players to watch. I'm just not putting all my eggs in a basket that stands 5'9"
over the course
of a playoff series if you have LeBron on the other end.
Yeah, that's fair. Sarah, do you give either of these teams a chance, or do you think Cleveland is definitely going to the finals?
Man, I definitely think Washington could get a game or two off of them, but I don't know that I'd really give them a solid chance to win the series. Cleveland's just been so dominant. I know Mort is suggesting that perhaps LeBron could be human, but we've seen no evidence thus far to really support that. So, I would go Cleveland regardless. I thought coming into the playoffs, though, that there was a chance they might not make it to the finals, but that's all kind of gone now.
Yeah.
I think they're going.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think if I had to pick it today, I would say Cleveland and Boston over 5. Cleveland and Washington over 6. I'm with you, Mort, in thinking Washington has a better shot, but unless LeBron decides to pull a James Harden and not show up for a game, it seems like we're headed toward Cavs Warriors 3, which I don't know why people are not excited about, as if those last two series haven't both been fantastic. Like, that last year's series was one of the most memorable in recent memory, and yet people are like, oh, damn, we're going to have another Cavs Warrior series. So
it's because this dude named Kevin Durant,
right,
and the Cavs defense has been really, really, I don't see if it can get to the level that it got to last year.
That's fair.
That's the only reason.
Yeah, that is fair. All right, let's turn our attention now to Sixers Christmas, the NBA Draft Lottery, and the NBA Draft.
Oh, no. NBA Christmas. Like, over here, it's second Christmas. NBA Draft is always second Christmas. We all get presents.
But it's Sixers Christmas, or it could be Sixers Christmas this year, especially because, Sam Hinkie's machinations over the last, like, 4 or 5 years could all really come into play Tuesday night.
Don't you dare.
Let's talk about the combine quickly first, and then we're going to use Tankathon to simulate a draft lottery and briefly go over that. Mm-hmm. So, Mort, any major takeaways from combine, whether winners and losers from 5-on-5 play, anyone stand out from the measurements, etc.?
Jonathan Jean is 7'2" in shoes. He's got a wingspan of 7'6.5", and his standing reach is 9 feet 5.5 inches. I don't know how you top that. That measurement alone is amazing. Then comes the fact that he is actually an improving 3-point shooter. I mean, that to me sounds like a guy who can come into this league, probably take a couple of years, and then potentially become a star. And right now he's rated, I haven't checked the DX's mock draft, but I don't think he's that high up. So that's one takeaway I have there. He was the one guy that really stood out to me.
Okay. Sounds right. I know the kid from Kentucky, the rising freshman, it sounds like his athletic testing was off the charts, and John Calipari gave a great quote that if he goes in the lottery, John Calipari is retiring.
Yeah.
There's nothing more he could do. If he can just sign a player and literally not have him play at Kentucky, not play a single minute in college and still get him drafted in the lottery. It's fair. I don't know what more you can do there.
So I'm not really perfect in this pronunciation. I'm going to butcher it, but his name is Hamidou Diallo, right?
It sounds right. Yeah. I'll learn how to say it in the next month, probably.
Oh, yeah. There are like a couple of names in this draft. Yeah. This is a particularly tough one when it comes to pronunciation. Stacey King is going to have to retire.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's going to be fantastic. All right. Let's talk about... So, Markelle Fultz, the presumptive number one overall pick. The only team among the top eight that he refused to meet with at the Combine is Orlando, which just doesn't bode well for Orlando. But I'm sure if Orlando ends up winning the draft lottery on Tuesday, that stance will change. According to Chad Ford of ESPN.com, prospects also refused to meet with the Kings because they're just still a disaster. And one agent was just like, this would be complete mismanagement if I let my clients go there. And the Celtics, surprisingly, because, you know, at first you think, well, you know, my prospect's going to go to a 50-win team. Like, he has a chance to win a ring within the next year or two. But then, you know, think about most teams, if you've got a top three, top four pick, you suck. So you're going to get a guy who's supposed to be the face of your franchise. He's going to play a lot of minutes. He's going to get a lot of exposure, then get a huge second contract. The Celtics... You know, especially if they get a top two pick and draft a point guard, you got like four or five other guys they need to beat out on the roster. I mean, that may only be the case for a year, but there's a lot of... that depth chart is very crowded at every position. So, Mort, do you think because of that, should Boston, you know, assuming it does not win the number one pick on Tuesday, should the Celtics be even more... Should they try to trade that pick, basically? Should they be more willing to part with it?
You know, I'm going to say yes, and I've said that for a long time, but Celtics fans have repeatedly come after me, in regards to this with the argument, and this is a fair argument, that they could not only have like a top rookie, even if they finish fourth in the lottery,
right?
Then they'll also have enough cap space to get a guy. So they could get... Yeah. Two guys, whereas if they trade the pick for a guy earning like a lot of money, that would just turn into being one guy as opposed to two.
I see. Yeah.
That is fair logic, honestly. So it makes sense. Having said that, we all know the draft isn't a guarantee.
Right.
If you could get a guy like an all-star caliber player and he just fits like a glove right into your team, you gotta do it. Paul George for like the fourth pick?
Right.
I mean, I know there's the whole risk of him leaving. I get that. But don't tell me that if he somehow wins a ring there, that he'll be like, nope, going to the Lakers.
I don't
think that's happening. Like, if you could get a Paul George for the fourth pick, you gotta do it.
Yeah.
Even if you have to attach assets as well, like a Terry Rozier.
Yeah, you probably have to attach something of value, but I would think I'm with you in that regard. Because, you know, I think back to the Sixers in 2010, they had the number two pick, and at the time it was like, hey, we got Evan Turner, he's a better Andre Iguodala, and now look at him later, you know, 6 years down the line, and it's like, Evan Turner's making how much money?
Yeah.
And he's now basically an albatross in Portland. So.
Did anyone outside of Philly fans say that?
At the time? Yeah, that was a two-person draft at the time. Because DeMarcus Cousins was, I mean, he was the second best prospect based on talent, but he already had the questionable, you know, the intangible question marks, which have remained a question to this date. And at the time, the Sixers coach was Doug Collins. There was no way Doug Collins and DeMarcus Cousins were going to coexist well. What we should have realized is, hey, fire the coach. The prospect's going to be around longer. Instead, they took Evan Turner.
It was a three-man draft then, because John Wall went first.
Right, John Wall was first. Yeah, right. I'm removing him from the equation.
Oh, okay, then, yeah.
Yeah, and then it was if right. Yeah, oh god, if we had gotten number one, that would not have been a question. But at number two, it was Turner, DeMarcus Cousins, Derek Favors was in there as well.
Oh, he was, yeah.
Yeah,
Wesley Johnson. Everyone thought he would be amazing. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah.
But I think you're right in saying, you know, the draft is a crapshoot. Mm. Like, if you get the number four pick, you're probably getting Jason Tatum, most likely, right?
Right.
And the best case scenario Carmelo. Is that Jason Tatum develops into, Carmelo, Paul George, develops into that caliber of player. But that's not going to happen for, 5 years at least?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, well, I don't know. I think we've seen, developments being sped up a little, so maybe not 5 years, but definitely in that range, 3 to 5 years. So they have to wait, and at that point in time, Al Horford is going to be old.
Right.
And yeah. Isaiah Thomas is probably going to be old as well. So
yeah.
I'm just going to plug a little piece I wrote for FanRag regarding the draft.
Please do.
I wrote a piece called Trading Down is a Smart Strategy for Teams in the Middle of the Round 1. Because this draft, after the top 10 or so guys, everyone from the 10th or 12th pick down to the latest parts of the first round, 30th, they can go wherever, because that's just one big pile of players that could go whichever direction. Yeah. So if you are a mid-range team, a Miami drafting 14th, assuming they don't win the lottery, let's just stick with the 14th there. It might be worthwhile trading that 14th for number 22 and 27 for Brooklyn. Mm. All depending on Brooklyn falling in love with someone that they need to get a little bit earlier in the draft. Because if it's a crapshoot anyway, why not get two as opposed to one?
Right.
That's a strategy that could be utilized. Not for Boston specifically, because they need a game changer.
Yeah.
But now that we're on the subject of the draft, I feel as though that's an important part that's going to play in, because I have a feeling that a lot of teams would be willing to move later round picks so they could get more quantity of players in, especially because for this draft is projected to be deep.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I'm kind of thinking Boston could theoretically get in on that. If they draft fourth, that's not a Lonzo Ball. That's not a Markelle Fultz. That's, like you said, a Jason Tatum.
Yeah.
So why not maybe trade down for two mid first round picks and some young guy who is really effing good, because all those guys are going to be cost controlled anyway,
right?
And then you have the foundation to move forward, which it seems like they're hell bent on doing for some reason, even though they signed Al Horford.
right.
Which, so let's just take Horford out of the equation. That would give them a ridiculous building block for the future. Then you just have to figure out what do we do from there? Do we play both sides? Do we go development, or do we go win now, or do we toe it like the Bulls try to do, only better?
Right. It seems like that's their strategy, and we should know it. Sacramento, if they don't move up, they have 8 and 10, so maybe that's a possible trade partner for. But yeah, I mean, based on, especially going back to your article for a minute, a number of teams have multiple picks in the late first round. Utah has 2 in the 20s, Portland has 2 in the 20s, so I could see that if they fall in love with someone at 16, 17, trade those two late 20s picks and move up.
The Jazz have 24th and 30th, which is still a great position. But, the guys who could run away winners of this draft, Portland. Because they have two late picks and they have a mid-range pick, a mid first round pick. If they ship that mid first round pick to Brooklyn for 22 and 27, then they're going to have 4 picks in the 20s. And someone is going to be there who would probably, under normal circumstances, be a lottery pick. Maybe even a couple of guys. Portland needs a starting small forward. They need a backup point guard. They need a hell of a lot of things to round out their team. So if they trade down with that one mid first round pick that they're going to have, good Lord, they could fill a lot of holes.
Yeah. I think roster space might be an issue, but they could always draft and stash one or two of those guys. So
exactly.
We'll definitely have some reaction to the actual lottery next week and the implications and whatnot. I was going to talk about LeVar Ball today, but then I A, I hate talking about LeVar Ball, and B, I think it actually makes more sense to table that until after the lottery so we know kind of which team is in position to get him. So, Mort, without further ado, I'm about to open your... Mort ran, before we start recording, he ran a simulation on Tankathon just so we can play out a fake lottery quickly. So I'm about to open
it. Oh, you're going to hate it. You're going to hate it. I've stayed quiet.
Oh. And, okay, so in this fake simulation, Orlando wins the number one pick.
Which we just talked about with Markelle Fultz not wanting to talk to him.
Right, he would probably go talk to them then. Boston is 2, Phoenix is 3, Sixers are 4 via the Lakers, and 5, and then everything else stays the same. Yep. So, Mort, let's just run through a fake top 7 or 8 quickly.
Let's do it.
Orlando, you're going Fultz?
You gotta.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Boston is on the clock at number 2. What do you do if you're Boston?
Lonzo Ball.
Okay. Oh my God. Please God, let that happen. I want nothing more than LeVar Ball to be on that team. So Phoenix at number 3. You're going Josh Jackson?
Oh, I didn't think I'm going to reach for Jason Tatum there.
Ooh, interesting. What makes you say Tatum over Josh?
I'm honestly not sure. It's because of the organization, I think. It's a need thing. They need to have that versatile scorer. Josh Jackson is looking like he would be better suited for a team that's more established. Because he's not a high scorer. He's sort of like a Draymond. He can come in and handle the ball. He can rebound. He can run. But he's not a guy who can take over. And Jason Tatum's development, I feel, would be sped up a lot if he ended up in Phoenix.
Interesting. Okay. So then Sixers are on the clock at 4 and 5.
Right.
You make 2 picks for Brian Colangelo. Fire away.
Well, obviously Josh Jackson there, even though but it's going to be tricky though, because then he's going to have to split time with both Saric and Ben Simmons. It's, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a lockjam there.
We're familiar with that. Don't worry.
And then, you know, I'm actually going to stick to it with DX's mock draft, because I am in love with De'Aaron Fox, even though he can't.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know we've spoken about this before. The shooting woes are there, but I can't get over the fact of how good his release looks. And I can I also can't get over the fact that when he shoots, that ball is, like, right there.
Yeah.
Like,
his shot's not broken. It's not broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's minor tweaks. If he ended up with San Antonio, he would probably end up his rookie year and, you know, shoot 37% a la Kawhi.
Right.
Like, Chip would just go, "Hey, De'Aaron, come to me, my son. I will teach you the gift."
Move your hand 2 inches and you're going to hit 45%.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think the shot is there. I just think it's a matter of just nurturing it a little bit.
Yeah, and it's worth noting he just annihilated Lonzo Ball in the Sweet 16 during that matchup. It was 39 points to 10. So,
right.
Yeah, it sounds like De'Aaron Fox has been one of the high risers since the tournament, but nothing has changed in the 2 months since. It sounds like it would be a surprise if he's outside of the top 6, top 7. Okay, so Minnesota now on the clock at 6.
Malik Monk.
I like it.
Because here's the thing, he is not a creator, he's a jump shooter.
Yep.
And he's kind of like what Klay Thompson was before Klay developed his ball handling skills. You can live with that when you have that many players around you who can do things with the ball. Like Karl-Anthony Towns can handle the ball. Andrew Wiggins will handle the ball, even though he needs to brush up on it a little bit. When Zach LaVine comes back, he'll handle the ball. All depending on Ricky Rubio returning or not, he'll handle the ball. That's fine. Malik Monk can be that Reggie Miller type, you know, running off screens, like Reggie Miller / Rip Hamilton guy, coming off a bunch of back screens and then spotting up, because Lord knows that jumper is legit. That would fit in.
And he'd be fed by Rubio for the time being, and then Chris Dunn long term. So it's they could have their backcourt of the future.
Well, I'm not sure about Chris Dunn anymore, but we can take that in a later draft
for another day. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Zach LaVine is recovering from the ACL, so that gives them some insurance at the two. That would be a fun pick there. Okay, let's do New York at 7.
See, I want to pick someone really bad just because it's New York, but I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I think Dennis Smith.
Mm, okay.
I'm going to reach a little bit because Dennis Smith is an explosive athlete, and he's one of those scoring point guards. And I've seen quite a few games with him, and he strikes me as one of those guys who could have not quite a Derrick Rose career, but one of those scoring lead guards who could end up averaging like 20, 23 and 6 assists.
Yeah.
Like one of those guys. And, you know, New York seems to love their scorers, and so why not? It makes sense.
And they desperately need a point guard unless they want to bring Derrick Rose back.
Exactly. So why not get like the next guy, the next Derrick Rose type?
Yeah, I know there are a couple Sixers writers out there who write for Liberty Ballers that are very high on Dennis Smith. So that you did not make a bad pick for New York as much as you wanted to. So Sacramento at 8. Let's stop there. Are you gonna finish with Jonathan Isaac stopping his draft day slide? There you go.
Yeah, I am, obviously. I feel bad for Jonathan now because I just ruined his development.
Right. Yeah.
Poor Jonathan going to the Kings. Like, look, if the Kings end up with 8 and 10, I'm going to be so sad because that means there are two guys in the draft who's going to get messed up.
Right.
That's really how I look at it now. Yeah. That's really sad.
That's how agents are looking at it, apparently.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
And I mean, well, there is the hope that, they would trade one of those guys a year or two down the line once Vivek sours on them and realizes they are not all Steph Curry clones like he did with Nick Stauskas. But especially for a developmental prospect like Isaac, that's about the worst situation he could end up in.
1, 2, 3, Jonathan rocks. I'll never get tired of that one. Never.
No. That was, that will never stop being funny. Just a reminder to everyone that the draft lottery is Tuesday. I believe it will be before Game 2 of the Western Conference Finals. So watch that. Pray for the Sixers. Pray for hilarity. I think the funniest outcome would be like Sacramento winning the lottery. So then the Sixers take that pick. New Orleans going 2. So they keep their pick. Phoenix going 3. So Boston falls to 4. And then the Lakers giving their pick to the Sixers.
No, I'm going to beat you now. I'm going to beat you with this one.
Okay.
The true winner of the lottery has to be Dallas because they've done it right. They were awful, and they deserve some good luck right now because of the way that they've rebuilt. Markelle Fultz in Dallas? Forget about it. I would love that.
That would be fun. Yeah, and then Nerlens would have a real point guard for the first time in his NBA
And there career. We have the Sixers spin again. Yeah.
There we go. All right, so everyone check out Spurs Warriors today, Game 7 tomorrow, Draft Lottery Tuesday. It's a good time to be an NBA fan. Thanks again for listening to the NBA Podcast. Just remember to follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find all three of our handles in the Twitter bio, so check us out as well. You can find us on iTunes, so be sure to subscribe, download, leave some reviews, and you can find our iTunes link at the bottom of our Audio Boom player if you're listening to this on FanRag Sports, where we're being hosted this year. So check FanRag out on Twitter, at FanRag Sports, and for their NBA content, at FanRag NBA. As always, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. Sarah, good luck to your Spurs today.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right.
Take care, guys.
Take it easy, guys.
Bye.